This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Lootings, carjackings, and violence in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina have left New Orleans and Biloxi, Mississippi in chaos as people still in those cities become increasingly desperate for aid, fresh water, food, evacuation, and shelter. President Bush plans to tour the region on Friday. He's enlisted his father, former President Bush, and former President Bill Clinton to lead a fundraising campaign for victims. We'll bring you coverage of their meeting this afternoon after it happens. The Pentagon said today it will put 24,000 fresh National Guard troops on duty in Louisiana and Mississippi over the next 3 days, even as a former mayor of New Orleans called for a relief effort on the scale of 9/11. In New Orleans today, fights erupted as buses were loaded to evacuate some of the tens of thousands from the misery inside the Superdome. Thousands more arrived and jammed the concourse outside the dome, but were held back by barricades. The ambulance service in charge of taking sick and injured from the Superdome suspended flights after reports that a shot was fired at a military helicopter. If you're in the region, we know electricity and phone service are rare, but if you have access, give us a call. Tell us what's happening. If you're in a city receiving refugees, we want to hear from you as well. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, we'll ask about planning and preparation for evacuation and the difficulties involved in allocating resources between search and rescue and control of looting. But we begin in Texas, where the first of hundreds of busloads of evacuees from the Superdome arrived at the clean and air-conditioned Houston Astrodome earlier today. NPR's Robert Smith joins us by cell phone from just outside the Astrodome. Nice to have you on the program, Robert.
It's great to be here.
Robert, is there a sense of relief for those arriving from New Orleans today?
Oh, and how. We haven't been able to get inside the Astrodome, and they're about to lead us on a tour in there just seconds away. So if I cut out, it's because I'm inside this concrete monstrosity. But although it looks ugly on the outside, I've talked to people who have come out, and they just, to see the look on their faces when they describe what they had for breakfast, grits and sausage and egg and toast and orange juice and every kind of iced beverage they could possibly get. It's like breakfast has never tasted so sweet to these people.
Now, the plans call for the Astrodome to accept only those 25,000 or so who are leaving the Superdome.
Yeah, that was the plan. The county executive here said that plan just went out the window, and I was actually here last night when it went out the window, which was when a school bus arrived with people who had been picked up along the side of the road, and the Red Cross eventually just said, we got to let them in. And so I've talked to people who have come, they've hitchhiked here, who have come on borrowed rides, people who have come on buses run from a military base, they said. So it's not just the Superdome. In fact, it seems that there's still a lot of people still in the Superdome and still need to come here.
So. Oh, yeah, we'll be hearing more about that later and more people arriving at the Superdome in expectation of evacuation, though we are told today that in addition to the 25,000 or so expected in Houston, the cities of Dallas and San Antonio have also promised to make room for 25,000 or so.
Yeah, I mean, this is the amazing part of this, which is nobody knows how many people are coming. Communication is just too spotty, and they just simply don't know. And so they're doing sort of an elegant winging it here in Texas, which is to just open facility after facility, and when one is full, move on to the next one. And there's only a few thousand people here inside the Astrodome, so they still have 15,000-18,000 more they can take. But even with that, they must feel that that will only last a couple of days because they've decided to open many facilities in San Antonio and in Dallas to try and reach the need that they can't even calculate at this point. Now, I should just say I'm stepping into an elevator. We're going to go to the top of the Astrodome. If I lose you, I'm sorry. If I don't, then you're going on an audio journey.
Okay. Try to bear with us, Robert. We'll hope that coverage persists, though the metal sometimes in elevators makes it difficult. I did want to ask if lessons have been learned from the experience inside the Superdome. One of the big problems that people there had was that once in, they weren't allowed to go out.
Well, the Red Cross says their policy is that you can go in and out of this facility. And I think the Red Cross really is trying to do everything differently here. I mean, just from the moment you walk in, you see all these cots lined up in a perfect row, and the air conditioning, the lights, and the way they're treating them, I think this is going to be the anti-Superdome. And are you still with me?
Yes, we're still with you.
Well, I'm about to walk on the upper tier here of the Astrodome and get our first look of the floor of the Astrodome. And wow, I saw this last night when they were setting up the cots. And remember I said it was perfect order?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now refugees have descended, and it's a patchwork. It looks like people have just piled up tons of belongings on each and every cot, so many open cots, but everybody's claiming their cots while they still can. They probably learned that in the Superdome. Oh, there's a kids' play area in what would be the end zone. It looks like there's some... It looks like construction tubes. I don't know if they should be playing on that, but they've roped it off, and the kids look like they're in a playground. They're running around. There's a lot of people now who have yellow shirts, which clearly they've been given here. I see people lining up to get, looks like towels. I heard from someone that they were getting clothes, that they could get all the beverages and food that they wanted. But it's quite a scene because it's you know, more than the size of a football field, and it looks about... maybe a fifth full now.
Mm-hmm. Is it still? I know it's been years since they hosted any sporting events there. It's still set up as a football stadium.
Well, there's no. I mean, it's in the widest configuration possible. So there's no goalpost. There's no. It's concrete flooring. But there's still the banners hanging, the championship banners hanging, and there's still these. I don't know if you remember the Astro colors of red, orange, yellow.
Vividly.
You can't forget that sort of look of the 70s that the stadium had. So it still has that. And the amazing thing is that there's a glass ceiling to the Astrodome. A lot of people may not know this, but because they covered it up for baseball, it was too bright. But now it's like having a giant sunroof. It's like I said, it's the opposite of the Superdome because the light is just streaming in here, and it's like being outside. But of course, I think the temperature is like 58 degrees.
Well, obviously, they're anticipating the arrival of more thousands. We'll warm it up just a tad, I suspect.
Well, some of the refugees said they were warned that there were dozens and dozens of more buses arriving just today, and so they were starting to get a little concerned that they needed to grab their cots and a little worried that they would, they're a little afraid of overcrowding. You can understand that after their experiences.
One of the concerns also will be security. Evidence of much of that? Is there much evidence of that?
Oh, it's a very secure facility. And, in fact, the sheriff was saying earlier that there had been a couple of incidents which involved having their officers having to move on individuals. But the mayor of Houston wanted to stress that these facilities will have a ton of security. But he wanted to say it's not like we're treating these people as criminals. There's just a happens to be a criminal element whenever you put 25,000 people in one place. But he did stress that there would be strict, in and out access, that they would be searching people when they went in and that kind of thing.
Obviously, people in the Superdome will have, when they arrive in Houston, will still be desperate to find relatives, friends, some of whom still may be en route from New Orleans, some of whom may be still in the city, some of them who knows where.
Yeah, and one of the sadder things is outside the gates of the Astrodome, a lot of family members have shown up here, family members who live in Texas, looking for any word of people. Now, they're kept from this facility, and they have no access to the people in and out, and so it's a little sad to hear their story, and the last time they talked to their family members, and desperate to know if the family members were in here. And I should note that they've been so intent on giving these people food and water and medical checkups that they haven't fully processed them all yet. So they haven't released the list. They don't know who's here. But SBC, the phone company, is supposedly providing 1,000 phone lines. And so the head of the Red Cross here said, if you are a family member of someone who you believe is going to the Astrodome, they will call you because they will have access to telephones today.
Robert Smith, thank you very much. We appreciate that dramatic tour as you got into the Astrodome there.
I have to say, it's actually a beautiful sight, and maybe it's because everyone just really looks happy.
Robert Smith, NPR's Robert Smith, joined us by cell phone from outside and then inside Houston's Astrodome. Just a few moments ago, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, spoke of the crucial role the Justice Department must play to secure the city of New Orleans and surrounding areas.
Security is a concern. It is a priority. And I think one message that I would like to leave today for the American people is that the Department of Justice, working with state and local officials, we will do everything that we can do to ensure law and order in the affected areas. We have to be successful in this endeavor, because if we're not successful, it makes our job in terms of evacuation and providing relief even more dangerous and more difficult.
Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez speaking just a few moments ago at a news conference held by federal officials here in Washington, D.C., as they laid out their plans to send aid, what aid and help they can, to affected areas in Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email totn@npr.org. Bill joins us on the line from Gorham, New Hampshire.
Good morning.
Hi.
Or good afternoon, excuse me.
Yeah, we're all losing track of time.
Yes, yes. My thoughts, and I really don't know if this makes sense or not. First, let me just say quickly, I really enjoy your show, and I think you do a great service to everybody in the country.
Well, thank you.
But beyond that, is my wife and I were discussing this morning that we have a home here that we could accommodate four people. And we really would be willing to do that, in fact, help the people with the airfare to get here for, yeah, I don't know if it took a couple months or 3 months or... something as such, and I suspect there's a lot of people all over the place that might have the same idea or same feeling, and I was wondering if it's at all possible to have something organized where there could be a clearinghouse, so to speak, to accommodate these people. I mean, we take refugees from all over the world, so this, you know what I mean? I don't know if this makes sense or not.
I don't know. I suspect that what you might want to do is get in touch with your local chapter of the Red Cross and see if they would seem to be likely people to help you think about it and perhaps organize it.
Yeah, I mean, and just a thought. And if I may say one other thing, and it just kind of aggravates me, for once I would like to see the White House answer a question about something. The press secretary was asked that why there wasn't more in place.
Mm-hmm.
At the federal level, anyways, prior to this occurring. I mean, there was 3 or 4 days' notice that this tragedy could and may and probably will occur, and it seems like nothing was in place.
It's a question we're going to explore later this hour, Bill, so all I can ask you to do is stay tuned for us.
Thank you very much.
All right, we'll be back after a short break. We're continuing to talk about Katrina. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Those remaining in the New Orleans Superdome have seen conditions inside deteriorate steadily since thousands arrived there on Monday, fleeing the rising waters of Katrina. Ann Gerhardt is a reporter with the Washington Post who spent some time inside the Superdome Wednesday. She joins us now by phone from Baton Rouge, or the capital of Louisiana. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation, Ann.
Oh, happy to be here. I mean, not, you know, certainly with you, but I mean, this is just the most dire catastrophe I can imagine.
What was it like inside the Superdome?
Well, it's very hot. It's muggy. It's quite dark. Conditions there had deteriorated steadily since Monday when the power went out and the plumbing broke down. So there's no running water. The toilets are overflowing. It's a frightening place, and people are quite miserable. There's been no effort or ability to communicate with them, so rumors run rampant in a crowd of 15,000 people desperate for information.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't ever take more than a few steps before someone would reach out and clutch at me and say, Miss, are you from FEMA? Miss, are you from the city? And, you know, it was just a sort of heartbreaking situation. I mean, I saw a woman cradling her tiny baby in a diaper. I said, how old is your baby? She said, 2 weeks, you know. You know, there just didn't seem to be any plan in place whatsoever, not just for the Superdome, but for New Orleans in general, as we are beginning to, I think, finally all recognize, you know, several days after this storm came through.
Mm-hmm. It must have, obviously, with no power, it was dark. When you say it was frightening, did you feel physically threatened?
I didn't feel physically threatened, no. I have to say, most people came to me hoping I could help them in some way. And when I told them I was a reporter, you know, they wanted to tell their stories very much. And they hoped that if I knew someone on the outside, could I please call and say that they were in there? And, you know, I wrote down some cell numbers and, you know, said I would try to get through. I do think, however, that to stay there for a period of days would feel dangerous. I mean, it was a chaotic situation, and it seemed to have organized itself in the way that humans instantly do. The very first layer had its own structure. There were boys playing soccer on the field. I did run across one boy who said that he lived in the projects where he played football, and he never thought he'd be playing football in the Superdome. So the resilience of children could be seen there in that first level. And families had set up their personal space and had boundaries and kept it neat. And, you know, the picnic cooler was at one end, and the children's toys were at another, and the clean diapers were clustered at a third end. And then as you ascended into the more darker and scarier reaches of the Superdome, you could feel that all begin to break down on the second level where all the toilets were. The floor was just slick with human excrement mixed with urine because no one could go in the bathrooms any longer. They were just that fetid. And so people would just try to find a space for themselves that they thought was a little away where they could relieve themselves. And on the third level where the sky boxes were, seemed like some people would disappear into dark rooms to abandon themselves to whatever it was they thought might, you know, amuse them or content them during this time. There was a ersatz speakeasy that someone had somehow gotten into a keg of beer, and, you know, if you knew where it was, you could go get your water bottle filled. One man told me he had lost everything, and, you know, he was happy to be able to find a little beer. And then up on the fourth level, in the most nether reaches, there were, that was where all the women said, you don't go up there. You know, they wouldn't let their children grow up there. That was where the boogeyman lived, essentially, and all the rumors that were existent about there's somebody stealing babies, there's someone raping girls. They seemed to flow from this sense that up there in the darkest regions was where the real problem was. And the National Guard spokesman for the area assured me that none of that had happened and that none of that was true. But in that kind of environment, I think, where people are completely absent any information and perceive that day after day goes by and they don't get any help, I think it breeds that kind of fear and anxiety and eventually misery.
What was it like today when you left New Orleans and headed up to Baton Rouge?
Well, I actually left last night. When I went into New Orleans yesterday, the city was closed to everyone except emergency personnel, and a few media managed to get in, you know, through careful means.
I wouldn't press you too hard on that.
They had said the water was no longer rising. We found a dry spot and kind of hiked through the flooded streets toward the Superdome. I was determined to get inside there because I hadn't seen anybody really describe what that was like in there. And when I came out 3 hours later, the water had risen another 2 feet. I mean, it was basically to my waist level, and I had to wade back through. So it was clear to me on the ground that the idea that place could be evacuated in 24 hours, you know, with a massive infusion of troops was completely unrealistic because the buses could not get anywhere near that place. The only vehicles who could ford those flooded streets were what the military calls, a deuce and a half, the huge trucks with the big tires. And you would have to either take people out on huge helicopters, which even so can only hold, what, maybe 30 people at a time, or you would have to ferry them on these trucks, which can maybe hold 15 people at a time, out to the buses on the interstate ramp maybe a mile away. So it was going to always be a very lengthy process. And furthermore, the plan always was that they had to evacuate the 300 people who were patients of the infirmary set up alongside, who needed to be sent away to hospitals around the state of Louisiana before they could think about also evacuating these thousands and thousands of more able-bodied but very desperate and failing people from the Superdome itself.
And as we've heard today, once they did start the evacuation, more and more thousands arrived from hotels and various other places in New Orleans trying to get on those buses themselves.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. Because, I mean, I have to say, Neil, what I have been so struck by, and I heard this from people over and over again, they would say to me, I don't understand. You know, we drop packages into the desert. Why can't they drop water onto this bridge? I don't understand. I mean, we go into Afghanistan and we get control. I just don't, you know, I mean, there was just this sort of confused quality to a lot of people wondering why help hadn't come more quickly. And so it's become increasingly clear you think you can wait in a hotel, but nobody's going to come get you. So information spreads along one mouth to the other, and people finally were beginning to make their way over to the Superdome in the hopes that that was the only way out. But when I left New Orleans last night, knowing that the situation was getting increasingly dangerous on the streets and that the water was rising and you simply cannot be without your car, that will be your end as well. So you've got to get out of there while you still can. There were people just walking out of town, carrying their children on their backs on these hot, dusty interstates. It was, you know, like a scene in Oklahoma in the 30s.
And Gerhardt, we're glad you made it.
Well, thank you. Thank you, and it's good to talk to you again, and, it's good that you are showcasing the problems down here.
Okay, thanks very much. Bye. Good luck. Ann Gerhardt, a reporter for The Washington Post, who joined us by phone from Baton Rouge in Louisiana. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Jennifer. Jennifer calling us from Shreveport, Louisiana.
Hi there. I can just barely hear you.
Go ahead. You're on the air, Jennifer.
Okay. I just wanted to let everyone in Shreveport know how proud we are of the citizens in Shreveport and how nice everyone has been to the folks that are up from New Orleans. I'm from Shreveport. This is, luckily, you know, we were spared by all the disaster down there. But we have welcomed these folks with open arms. We have two huge shelters set up. I have friends I know that have big houses that have taken in families. One of my friends said he had room for eight, and so he was taking in a family of eight. Where there's drop-off points for donations all over town. And the biggest thing that they need in the two biggest shelters that we have, which is Hirsch Coliseum has opened a shelter, and I'm not sure how many they can hold, but I think there's about 10,000 seats, so I don't know how many cots that'll hold, but they need baby items. They need baby items. They need diapers. They need pull-ups. And, you know, you think about these mothers, they've been holding these babies with nowhere to sit them down for a week now. So you can imagine being a new mom and, you know, even if you've never been in this situation, imagine being a new mom and just wanting to go take a shower, having no place to put your baby. You can't lay them on the floor. You can't, you know, they don't have a car seat. They don't have a high chair, no walker, no nothing. I'm a mother of twins, so I had lots of stuff to spare. My three-year-olds had clothes that I'd piled up. I took that all down there, and they were so happy to see diapers that my kids had outgrown and clothes and baby blankets and just a car seat. Even if it's a worn-out car seat that doesn't have the straps or whatever, somewhere for a mother to lay her child so she can, you know, get a minute of, you know, let her arms rest.
Well, Jennifer, it sounds like there's a lot going on. We appreciate the update.
There is a lot going on, but, we're handling, the roads themselves are just full of people. Shreveport has, I think the population of Shreveport has tripled in the last week. But, you know, we're doing the best we can to help these folks, and the citizens of Shreveport are helping more than I ever knew we were capable of.
It's important to remember that there's a lot of human kindness erupting, as well as some less attractive aspects of human nature. Jennifer, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Here's an email we got from Monica Miller. My husband works at Fairmont Homes in Napanee, Indiana, and my husband called me today and told me there's a long line waiting to get hired to help build the FEMA units my company just received. I want to reassure everyone they're being built as I write this. My husband makes the countertops. They're hiring more people to get these out to you. Bless you, and may you know that there are hundreds of people working overtime to get shelter to you through FEMA. That from Monica Miller in Napanee, Indiana. We're taking your calls if you'd like to join us. We're continuing to talk about the crisis that has emerged after the passage of Katrina through New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Jackson, Mississippi did not suffer the enormous amount of damage that towns like Biloxi and Gulfport did, but it's feeling effects nevertheless. Several hundred residents have no power. There are still down power lines and trees to be cleared. Many people from the coast fled to Jackson, some coming from as far away as New Orleans. NPR's David Shaper joins us now from Jackson. Good to have you on the program, David.
Good afternoon, Neil. Thanks for having me.
Any idea how many evacuees have arrived there?
Well, I am in the Jackson Coliseum. This is on the Mississippi State Fairgrounds in downtown Jackson, which is a mini version, if you will, of the Superdome in New Orleans or the Houston Astrodome. And there are about 1,200, 1,300 refugees, I'm told, here. Most of them had come prior to Katrina hitting, and most of them are from New Orleans or the Mississippi Gulf Coast near New Orleans. And it's an amazing scene. I mean, it's you know, compared to what we just heard about what things were like in the Superdome, this is luxurious. I mean, air conditioning is working. The there's running water, working bathrooms, and people are doing what they can to make it seem as homey as possible. But they are sleeping on blankets set up on concrete floors with their own little corner of space and trying to have some semblance of normalcy.
It must be beginning to dawn on people that this is people running on adrenaline, obviously dealing with an emergency, but this is going to run for weeks and weeks and months and months.
You know, most people you talk to initially say they're thankful that they made it out and they're thankful that they made it here. The primary concern is those who left people behind, particularly those who left people behind in New Orleans, and they haven't been able to get through to them and they haven't been able to hear from them. I talked to one person yesterday whose grandmother was in the Superdome. She knew that as of yesterday, but had no idea if she was ever going to get out of there. And this is an 82-year-old woman with considerable health problems. And, beyond that, they are starting to think about how long they're going to have to be here and how long they'll be away from home or if they'll ever be going back. Some are trying to make plans to go to relatives, either in Texas or other parts of the country. It's a Herculean task, though, for some people because they barely got out with the clothes on their back. Some have a little bit of stuff with them. A lot of them didn't bring a lot of money, and a lot of them don't have a lot of money to begin with, and they have cars. But, you know, one person I was talking to, their car has been needing repairs, and they can't make a cross-country trip right now to stay with some relatives unless they get their car repaired, and they have no idea how long that might be.
Yeah, and obviously, if they don't have money, gasoline is both precious and rare. I would think
it's precious. It's certainly rare around here. You know, with the widespread power outages, it's certainly it's coming on gradually in Jackson itself. But in the outlying areas, there are still widespread power outages, and that means gasoline pumps won't work, so people can't get gasoline. When a gasoline station gets power and turns on, there are hour and 2 hour and 3 hour long lines waiting. They run out of gas within a few hours, and then they have to wait a couple of days until they get resupplied. The amazing thing is that prices, at least what they've been showing on their signs, haven't increased much at all in the last couple of days. Still $2.49 or $2.59 a gallon.
Well, that's compared to much of the rest of the country. That's not so bad.
Right. And I don't know if they just haven't adjusted their signs or just resigned to just doing what they can. I mean, people working there are so busy they may not have time to change the sign.
Mm-hmm. There's plenty of food and water for all of these people?
There is. There's been an amazing outpouring of support from the people of Jackson itself, and these are people who are without power themselves, who are without, you know, refrigerators and freezers, and they're bringing, the last couple of days, brought their perishables that they knew that they were going to lose anyway here so that they could be used to make meals for the refugees. They've been going to the Targets and the Winn-Dixies and that sort of thing to buy bottled water and diapers for the people here. And they're very well stocked right now. And there's actually the lunch line has been going for the last hour and a half or so, and it's still fairly long. And those coming away from it seem to be coming away fairly well fed.
David Shaper, thanks very much.
Anytime, Neil.
NPR's David Shaper joining us on the phone from Jackson in Mississippi. And we are getting reports from the Associated Press that congressional officials are saying that Congress will reconvene a little bit earlier than anticipated and look to pass a $10 billion measure for relief for Hurricane Katrina victims. Congress, of course, was on a recess summer vacation when the storm hit and was due to reconvene next week. They're now expecting that bill to pass before the weekend. When we come back from a short break, we'll continue taking your calls about Katrina, and we'll also discuss 1 year after the enormous tragedy that claimed the lives of more than 300, a tragedy told through the eyes of the children of the Russian city of Beslan. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. One question likely to be debated for years: what happened to the evacuation process? Why were so many people left without a way to get out? Once out, where would they go? Dennis Maletti has studied evacuation processes all over the country for all kinds of disasters as former director of the Natural Hazard Research and Applications Information Center at the University of Colorado. He's the author of Disasters by Design, a reassessment of natural hazards in the U.S., and joins us now from his home in Rancho Mirage, California. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Good afternoon.
I understand it's early. There's still much to be learned about what happened in terms of Hurricane Katrina. What can you tell us so far? What have you observed?
Well, I've only observed things I've been able to see over the excellent news coverage places on TV have provided.
Mm-hmm.
And this appears to be one of, if not the largest, evacuation and disasters our nation has ever experienced. And there are some very unique things going on that don't typically characterize a typical evacuation, if you could call it evacuation typical.
Such as?
Well, for example, that so many people were left behind. Often in evacuations, not everybody evacuates.
Yeah.
But usually they're people who don't want to evacuate. And I would just hypothesize, since there's no way for me to know, that many of the people who didn't evacuate wanted to and didn't get to.
Yeah, presumably a lot of people either didn't have a car or didn't have the money or any place to go.
That's what I hear over TV, but I'm trained as a scientist, so I don't tend to believe what I hear over radio and TV, at least from a scientific point of view. But that's a good hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. Now, who ultimately makes the decisions about evacuations? Is this a local, a state, or a federal responsibility?
Oh, it's always in our society, in our country, a local decision. So it would be typically made by a mayor for a city, or a city manager if the city has no mayor.
So this is entirely a local decision?
It always is, yes.
And when a mayor or the local official, whatever he or she may be, says it's time to order an evacuation, what does that mean? They're presumably urging people to leave. They're not forcing them to leave.
Well, if it's a mandatory evacuation, they are suggesting that martial law has informally been declared and they're being ordered to evacuate. That happens very infrequently. Typically, it's an evacuation recommendation.
Recommendation.
Yes.
Now, how varied is the level of preparedness for disasters in various states?
It's very varied, and it varies on the basis of what hazard you're talking about, as well as what state or community you're talking about. So, for example, we have in this country, and we have had for 25 years, extraordinarily detailed, comprehensive evacuation plans for evacuations around nuclear power plants.
Mm-hmm.
However, in parts of the country where they don't perceive that they're at risk to, let's say, an earthquake, let's say in Missouri,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, is the state that's had the largest earthquake in the history of our country. I'll just tell you, it started in December of 1811 and ended in February of 1812.
Oh, my gosh.
And it broke windows in the White House and changed the course of the Mississippi River. But I'll bet you they don't have earthquake evacuation plans in the Midwest because they don't perceive that that's a hazard they have to worry about.
Well, this is, to some degree, a question of political will, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. We don't require evacuation planning in the country. We invented planning for emergencies and invented evacuation planning in this country, but it's very uneven. We only require it at the national level by law for evacuations around nuclear power plants. But we do know how to do it.
Well, given, obviously you're talking from a hypothetical basis, but looking at the situation in New Orleans, Mississippi, Gulf Coast, is there anything that disturbs you about this evacuation?
Well, I can tell you, I'm embarrassed. And this is me speaking as an individual. What embarrasses me is that in the most well-educated, most affluent society that's ever existed on the planet, that we have tens of thousands of people we couldn't move to safety. I'm embarrassed by that.
Should public officials be embarrassed as well?
Well, I can't tell people what they should be embarrassed about. I can tell you what embarrasses me.
Dennis Mileti, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Dennis Mileti, former director of the Natural Hazard Research and Applications Information Center at the University of Colorado, the author of Disasters by Design, a reassessment of natural hazards in the United States. He joined us by phone from his home in Rancho Mirage in California. Let's get a caller on the line. This is Donald. Donald calling us from San Francisco.
I was born and raised in New Orleans, and from what I've been watching on the news, it makes me angry to see, the way they talk about the people down there for looting and stuff. I mean, you just come out of water waist deep. You want to put on some warm clothes. You want to try and get something to eat. They show one knucklehead carrying a television and keep repeating that. But there's always going to be one in a bunch. Now, you talk about evacuating people.
Mm-hmm.
After the water clears, count the number of school buses and public service buses, that you got to drop a nickel in to get in and ride. The mayor should have had those buses lined up in neighborhoods to take, I talked to a few people before the hurricane came. I'm telling them, get out of the city. And they say, hey, where are we going to go if we get out? What are we going to do? We don't have any way to get, they didn't have transportation. A lot of people down there are poor. And the suffering that I see going on, I don't want to make call it a racist, country or whatever, bring that issue up. But I just look at the tsunami, how they airlifted water to the folks. And here it is, you got Texas next door, you have parts of Louisiana that wasn't touched. And you're going to tell me they can't airlift water to an area downtown where people were, dying of thirst, little babies. You drop bread out of a doggone plane,
Doesn't do much good to drop it in the water.
Huh?
Doesn't do much good
I'm talking about downtown. I'm talking about they keep showing by the convention center where everybody's huddled up,
mm-hmm.
and the area between the dome and the convention center, Porter Street or whatever, they can get water into the people. I don't think the government is making a strong enough attempt. And they're using a line talking about helicopters were shot at. And mm-hmm. I hear this general get on television. He said there wasn't anybody shooting at a Chinook. He didn't even know anything about it. It's something use a cover-up to show that they're not making progress and doing the job and getting the water and the food into the people. So they're going to take somebody shooting at, they shoot at helicopters in Baghdad every day and they're still flying, So why are they going to use, and here's the cameraman, the news people flying around saying, yeah, there's shooting going on, but the army won't fly? Come on, give me a break.
Donald, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but I wanted to thank you for the call. Donald calling us from San Francisco. And when we come back, it's the children of Beslan.